Welcome to the Free From Wall Street podcast, where we talk about how to create, preserve, and pass on generational wealth without the roller coaster ride of the stock market. And now, here's your host, Stephen Libman, managing partner of Integrity Holdings Group.
Steve, thanks for coming on. Introduce yourself. Introduce the little lady in the background there.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Appreciate you having me on. As you know, we welcomed our third baby to the world yesterday, so it's been a little bit of a whirlwind, but glad we got on here this morning. So, so we've been flipping for about a decade and been in real estate for about 15 years. I was a broker first, and I was working with some investors trying to find them good deals and then made them a bunch of money. And realized I could do it myself. And we started doing some flips, started doing some wholesales. We ramped that business because of Bill Allen's mastermind, the seven-figure altitude mastermind that he does. And in 2016, we did about 16 deals for 250 grand. The next year, we did over $1 million. Yeah. And we scaled our business to doing somewhere between 15 and 20 deals a month. And
it was
just a very active business. And it was a huge blessing for us. So that's Harper.
Yeah.
And she's my 2-year-old that's hanging out with us today. So my wife in the hospital with a newborn. So I apologize for the background.
All good.
Yeah. So we, again, really active business and it was good. But we couldn't. Give me 1 second, but. So super active business and it was a blessing. It really got us to where we wanted to go. And then we realized, man, this isn't going to get us to retirement.
Yeah.
So there was no real light at the end of the tunnel. And we know some really great operators that were bringing on chief operating officers to run their business. And at the same time, over the last 12 to 18 months before that, we were really looking into commercial buildings. We wanted to create some passive income. We thought maybe it would happen in the single family space by just buying a bunch of single family rentals. But everybody that we spoke to that were mentors of ours now and some partners in our own deals now, they basically told us, hey, you know, that's a very active business too. You're going to have to build a property management company to effectively manage those things. And once you get into 100 units or better, then you have the economies of scale. You guys are going to be able to hire third party management. You're going to be able to get, you know, professional attorneys, high echelon accountants, and the economies of scale just absorb the cost of those deals much better. And I said, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So why don't we go ahead and start doing that? So at the same time, brought on a chief operating officer, had a hole in the organization for doing acquisitions in the wholesale and flip business. And we had this deal, our first deal with our partner, Sean, that was an 1,193 unit self-storage complex come to fruition.
Jeez, that's a big one. That's not a little baby one.
Not a baby one. So it was a $14 million project and we had to raise $4 million in equity. And I could either solve the acquisition manager problem or I could solve the raise $4 million problem.
Yep.
And raising $4 million was a lot more beneficial long term. Right? Yes. It was pay us in perpetuity versus just pay us once. So, and then there's, you know, the acquisition manager position. It doesn't really solve the problem, right? It potentially solves the problem, but if they don't actually do something that starts bringing in the income, like if they don't work out. Right. Then it doesn't really solve it.
Yeah. And
we, you know, turnover kills us. So it was like, all right, let's go raise this $4 million and see if we can dive into the commercials.
Yeah. And then, I mean, ultimately it didn't align with long-term goals, it sounded like.
Yeah. And I didn't realize that. I mean, when we first started flipping and wholesaling, it wasn't that clear to me that we weren't going to retire that way.
Yeah.
Right. I figured we'd build this empire and we'd take that money and put it into passive income. But as you know, over the years, as we started to do it, It was like, well, building this big organization, it did two things. It created a lot of active work.
Yep.
And it worked us into the highest tax bracket that exists.
Yeah. So,
you know, last year I got crushed in taxes. This year I'll pay no taxes and I'll make more money. And
funny how that works out.
just doing the research on that, it was like, this is a no-brainer, right?
Yeah.
But the barrier to entry is higher. I mean, it's harder to get into these commercial deals because you need a track record, or you need a co-sponsor, or you need a balance sheet. You need a couple of different things that you don't need to get into wholesaling. Wholesaling, barrier to entry is very low.
Yeah.
To run a good organization takes some time and work and effort, but the barrier to entry is pretty low. To get into these large commercial projects, and we've acquired $70 million worth of projects this year, high barrier to entry. But there's some tips and tricks that I'll share to get into these deals without having the experience.
Yeah, no, that'd be awesome. So for me, that's been my mindset. I've been in wholesaling and flipping for about 2.5 years now. And when I got in, it was, I've got no money. I got to figure out how to get in the real estate. You know, all the top millionaires in the world have some fingers in real estate at some point or another, whether it's their main business or just something where they deploy their money. But so I was like, the obvious thing is to get into wholesaling. And then it was flipping. And then it was like, well, what's this private money thing I'm about? So it took me a while to get that out. And so it's been this evolution of deals. And then as you're in the real estate world, you're like, dude, real estate isn't just single family houses, 1,000 square foot little, you know, sticks and bricks. It's incredibly vast out there. And that's when I started looking into commercial, whether it was, I've looked at industrial buildings, I've looked at big old 6-10 story commercial buildings. And, but I think I finally dialed it down to where I just want to be in, I haven't decided if I want to be big apartments yet, but apartments and storage and maybe a little mobile home parks just because I have squirrel syndrome. But so I think it's an evolution of the active investor with an entrepreneur mind. You just like, Oh, that's exciting. Because like you said, you build this huge company for what? It's a giant active business that you can never turn off or step aside from. And that's the pain of building such a big company is being able to.
Yeah. And I don't know if the evolution is there for everybody. You know, yeah. I mean, I know people that are very happy with their wholesale and flip businesses. I guess it gets down to the why, right? Like, why are you doing what you're doing? Yeah. I don't love flipping. I don't love wholesaling. I don't wake up in the morning and go, oh man, I wonder what light fixture we can throw in this. Like, I don't really care, right? It's a business. Right.
Yeah.
But I do love creating a nice place to live for people where they can come home and, you know, have a good area for their family to grow up in. And, you know, so creating those apartment complexes, I mean, storage isn't sexy, but it's a need. So we like that because it's kind of autopilot. But I, you know, selfishly, I want to get into this business so that I can spend more time with my family, right? So we can generational wealth and build a legacy. And you're on a podcast with you at 9:30 in the morning and, you know, have my 2-year-old running around, not worry about getting to work.
Right.
You know, so the freedom that comes along with that. And then, you know, the bigger why for us is we want to be able to give back. And I would not be able to give as much as we're able to give by investing in commercial if I just stayed in the residential space. So,
yeah,
I mean, you're 100% right. It just didn't align with the long-term goals. It took some time to figure that out.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're getting there. But the evolution isn't the same for everybody. I think the top 10% of people in this space will probably go, hey, I think I can do that too. But because the barrier to entry is so high, I think a lot of people would just look at it and go, no, I can't do a $15 million deal.
Yeah.
And, you know, for me, I'm like, let's jump and grow wings on the way down.
And
we did, you know, we raised $4 million in 4 weeks for that project.
Wow.
And it was chaos, but it'll make us millions of dollars.
Yeah. So before we talk about that barrier entry, because that's one of my deals is, you know, we're doing all right in flipping and we're finally baby stepping into apartments, but it's like exactly what you said, $15 million. It's like, whew, that's a couple years down the road, But at the same time, I know guys that walk into real estate into their first multi-million dollar deal with essentially no money. I'm like, holy crap. Okay. So it's there. It's just, but
it's doable, man. I mean, we had investors for our flipping, right? You do too.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a very difficult revolution to get them to say, hey, we're going to not do this anymore. We're going to go put our money with you in this project because of the tax benefits. I mean, we're actually paying a lower rate than we were when we were flipping interest to our investors. But because of the tax benefits, they're taking home and keeping more of it.
Right.
You know, so yeah, it seems like it's too far gone. Like it's too big of a hurdle to clear.
Yeah.
But and the law of the first deal, you know, you just mentioned that you're going to be doing your first deal and it's going to be closing today. Yeah. Right.
Yep.
So congrats.
Thank you.
Michael Blanc talks about this on his podcast all the time, the law of the first deal. And once you do the first one, it starts to really rain deals. And, you know, I thought initially that was a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah.
But we did our first deal 14 months ago and it was $14 million project.
Yeah.
$70 million so far this year. That's our first year in commercial.
Yeah.
It's doable, right? With another potentially $30 million under contract
over the
3 months. So yeah, man, it's a mental hurdle.
That's awesome. I warm in my heart, man. okay. Yeah, yeah.
Good news.
No, that's why I started this podcast because you know, I think a lot of people just have those barriers and whatever it was. Like for me personally, I think I touched on this already, but it was always, as I got to the next level, I looked back and I'm like, well, why did I just do that earlier? Dang it. That was easy. The flipping. And then when I started marketing for commercial deals and now that I'm finally closing the commercial deal, I'm like, I should have just done this out the gate. Cause I'll be in this apartment and storage zero money.
Yeah.
If you just know how to do it.
Well, and you know, so the interesting thing is absolutely, if I could have started here,
yeah.
But one of my favorite quotes is the man who's on top of the mountain didn't land there.
Right.
Like it takes these different iterations for you to figure out how to get to that next level. Right.
Exactly.
I've never gotten to, you know, $100 million of assets under management in 18 months without wholesaling my first deal 10 years ago.
Yep.
I would have never, you know, it just, so yes, although I would have loved to start here, I certainly wouldn't have had the credibility.
Right.
Go and raise the amount of money that we've raised and partner with the type of people that we've partnered with without, you know, being able to run a successful wholesale and flip business. So I agree with you. I would love to start here, but it was all part of the necessary journey to get here.
Yeah. Right. I mean, without flipping, you said you're up to 15 plus houses a month without being able to do that. No, they wouldn't. To manage that many millions, they wouldn't have done that necessarily with someone that's doing one or two every other month or something.
Right. Totally.
Yeah. It's a evolution of events that had to happen. So you said that took a couple years, or once you were flipping wholesale, you know, the 15 plus a month, at what point, what year were you like commercials? Oh, you said 14 months ago. So it's been,
yeah,
or 17 bad. Months ago or whatever it was. Okay. So it was 13 years when you're like, oh, commercials where we need to be.
Yeah. I just, you know, every time we close the house and we, you know, I know you're looking at your HUDs going, oh, I thought I'd make more on this.
Every freaking time. Golly.
Every single time.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just frustrating because I'd get excited buying the deal and then I'd go, all right, we're going to crush this
deal. Yeah.
We don't necessarily crush it. And then I got to pay a huge tax bill on top of it. I'm like, man, this is really a job. And this isn't
right
at all. Like, and it's still not passive. I mean, I know guys have systems and operations and project managers and processes that really help them avoid a lot of the problems that I still deal with.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just my fault as a business owner, but I don't love solving those problems. I like other people to solve those problems.
Exactly. So like
when the tile guy calls out, I don't want to hear about it, right? I just want my GC to fix it and when it's done and still hit his timeline. But that's not happening. Meanwhile, I'm building, you know, 1,100 self-storage units And we've hired one of the largest general contractors in Florida to do that. And I get monthly reports, weekly aerial shots from his drone of the progress, monthly reports from the bank talking to me about what draws they gave out to the general contractor, and a third party manager that's looking at all this and saying, yeah, these things align with the work that he's done and the budget on track, under budget, on track, under timeline. I'm like, why is this huge project so much easier to run than a $30,000 flip?
Yeah.
And frankly, it's because of who you can afford to hire.
It's people. Yeah.
It's large projects.
Is this that, I saw on your Facebook, there's a 66,000 square foot deal with, is it Sean Crook?
Yeah.
That's
66,000 is only that center building. So
really,
total of 130,000 total rentable square feet by the time it's all built out.
Jeez, so that's nuts.
It's a football field. When you drive by it, and it's gorgeous, by the way. It's a class A. If you see some of the photos that we've been posting, it's like, it's just a really beautiful building, and it backs up to, you know, thousands of units of people that need storage. Florida has a high water table. They don't have any basements. The HOAs don't allow for RV and boat storage.
Yep.
So there's a lot of need down there, and we're going to fulfill it.
Yeah. That's incredible. That's incredible. I think commercial is too vast of a topic to really dig in, but what were kind of the evolution of steps going from the single family world and that rental passive world of the single family to the big commercial deals? Was raising money in that world different? But obviously the connections had to evolve as well, and the networking kind of changed, or
it did. I mean, because now the full-time job is telling people why commercial is better, right? Why are we getting out of the residential business and focused strictly on this?
Yeah.
And, you know, if you listen to Kiyosaki a lot, he talks about the miseducation that's going on in America and how the idea of going to school, getting a good job, making a good wage, and then investing that wage into stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and ETFs is a problem. And it's really an epidemic. And I talk about this a lot, where my dad passed away 6 years ago and lost nearly half of his portfolio in the stock market crash in 08, 09, and didn't live long enough to ride it back up.
Yeah.
And, you know, the volatility of the stock market is what got me initially into real estate, because it was something that was tangible, secure. I could touch it, feel it, drive by it. And that's why I liked real estate. And we have, you know, we have investors that are investing with us into vacant houses, right? They're putting their money into a vacant house. I think everybody knows at this point of the market, it's starting to cycle towards the top. We were talking about this a little bit before we started. Like, when the mailman wants to get into flipping, it's time to get out.
Yeah.
And we're overpaying for deals because we're kind of topping that cycle of the market. And, you know, as a wholesaler, that's actually good news, because that means distress will start to go up as the market starts to shift down. So there'll be more opportunity. But the conversation with our investors was, hey, we want to secure your capital more, right? Putting it into a vacant house is not super secure. Putting it into a 1,000-unit storage complex where if one tenant moves out, you don't feel it, is not a big deal. So if you're able to do that and get tax benefits, would you like to come over with us? And everybody was like, yeah, absolutely. But the education process is different, because people don't even know that they can invest in these deals, right? Yeah. Saying, hey, let me borrow money from you and go flip a property is one thing. And everybody kind of knows that if you know a flipper, you can invest with them. What people don't know is that they can be a partner in one of our deals and go buy a $15 million project and be completely hands-off and collect quarterly checks.
Yeah.
Your mutual funds are not sending you quarterly checks, and they're not sending them consistently, and they're not something that you can kind of say, oh, this is based on cash flow, not based on something else.
Yeah.
So if it's based on cash flow, then you're good, and you know that that money's coming in because you can actually control that cash flow.
Right.
But what you can't control is the comps next door, right? You get caught in downturn and your property is now worth $40,000 less than what you expected it to be. It's a problem.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And our days on market's getting a little bit higher too. So a little worrisome.
Yep. And I'm dropping my prices. So instead of being at 90% of what the ARV is, now I'm at 80% of what the ARV is, just so I can turn these things, right? So I got to buy them a little bit better. And everybody now is like, yeah, but the market's really good. So they want more and you need to buy them lighter.
Yeah.
So it creates some challenges for sure. But
yeah.
So now the full-time job, back to your question, is telling the story. It's educating people that they can invest into these types of deals, how to invest. And if the only way that they can really invest is if they know an operator, right?
Yeah.
If they know somebody like me or you that is buying and running these deals. You can't call Fidelity or Wells Fargo and say, hey, I want to invest in real estate. They're going to put you into a real estate investment trust that they can sell and they can capitalize on, but they can't make money on our deals, so they don't offer it, right? So they can only come into these deals if they know guys like us.
Right. So my extensive knowledge in the big commercial deals is either a fund manager or a fund will deploy that capital with certain GPs and KPs on their deals while retaining some sort of equity or managerial position, or it's syndicated. What type of business does Integrity Holding do?
So we do syndications right now. We do it on per project basis. I'm reading a book right now called Capital Attraction, and it talks about the evolution from getting into a per deal into a fund model. And I hope I don't shoot myself in the foot by saying this, but I don't ever want to do a fund. And here's why.
Okay.
One is I don't want the pressure to have to deploy that capital.
Right.
I don't want to go and bring $50 million into a fund and then have to go deploy that capital for it to start making money.
Right.
I know some friends, you know, I graduated from Boston University. I have some friends in finance that work on Wall Street that run some of these funds, and they're constantly underwriting deals, looking for the right, quote, right deal that fits their fund parameters to deploy money into.
Right.
And it's not that there's a shortage of deals or there's a shortage of money, but to really hit the metrics that we want to hit internally and to continue our conservative underwriting and to only do deals that we're really excited about. Yeah. I don't want to be sitting on a pile of other people's cash and say, man, I have to get this on the street. Otherwise it's not working. And then maybe make a mistake by picking the wrong deal to do that. So right now we like to do it deal by deal. It is a little bit more intense because you have a deadline, right? You get a property under contract and then you got to go beat the streets and raise the capital. So starting to get to a place where we're taking soft commitments from people where they understand the types of deals that we're doing and they're raising their hand and saying, hey, I've missed out on the last seven, but the next one that comes up, I want to be a part of.
Yeah.
And those people will be the first ones that we get, that we call and say, okay, we have this next deal. It fits all the of our parameters and this is why we're excited about it. And then people can jump in from there. So it takes a little more time and effort, I think, to do it this way. Mm-hmm. But I personally feel like it's safer for our investors' money to do it that way.
Yeah, no, that makes tons of sense. I mean, I've heard of companies like yours or syndicators, once the dollar amount gets substantial, not that yours are, but like 50 million plus, they go to these funds to raise that money. Kind of, is that something you envision in the future?
It's not. I don't like how they structure the deal. So I have a podcast myself. It's called Free from Wall Street.
Okay. So you won't be doing that.
So Wall Street and us, it's not that we don't get along. It's just that I disagree with their ethos on how they make money, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they make a lot of money. The investor doesn't. So if you look at your private equity investment or your mutual fund investment, we have, 6%, 8% going back to the investor.
Mm-hmm.
When you're really looking at 12% with us, you know, because we cut Wall Street out and it goes directly to them. So the fund managers are the ones making the money. And the fund managers that are making the money don't pass that on to their investors. So I'd rather just say, hey, Mr. Investor, just come and invest directly with me. And you don't, I mean, you know, if you look at your 401k statement or your mutual fund statement, right, the the thing that I think you should focus on is not your rate of return, but your fees. What are you paying for them to manage your money?
Yeah.
And that's a big thing that I think a lot of people are missing. I actually have a guy from my church that's invested with us who's making, who thought he was making 6%. And after fees and everything, it came out to be like 3.875%.
Jeez.
And he was telling me, hey, I'm taking 6% out every year to live for retirement.
Yeah.
Making 6%. So I should be breaking even and I could pass that remainder onto my kids as my legacy, right?
Yeah.
But it wasn't. It was 3.875%, and it ended up being 18 years that he could live off of his fund, or off of his funds, because it was decreasing every year. And then he changed that with us, and now he's living off of the same 6%, and it's growing by another 6%.
Right.
So, you know, his lifestyle has changed, and the legacy that he leaves, instead of it being zero, will be almost double what he has if he lives for 20 years and continues to invest with us. So those are the types of things that blow people's minds, because Wall Street is getting rich off the backs of people that are investing in their 401ks and mutual funds.
Right.
And we let them know, hey, you, with some education, you can do this yourself. Nobody's going to watch your money like you're going to watch your money. And by partnering with guys like us that have these deals that are, you know, smaller in scale, and they're not the Blackstones and Blackrocks of the world, they can do better. If I end up in the East River this weekend, you know why, because you
you talked about the hedge funds.
But it's the truth, man. You can make a lot more by self-directing your investments into deals directly versus just arbitraging Wall Street.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. And then for personal selfishness, as you went from single family to this world of commercial and raising the bigger dollar amounts, was it people or online platforms, or did you run back to school to learn all these things, or how did you go from, or was it just natural? You kind of already just knew a lot of it, because you got the podcast. So I assume a lot of it was already known.
No. So we just started the podcast just to tell our story a little bit more.
Yeah.
To be honest. So it's only been out, you know, a month.
Okay.
So it didn't have, and so just to be clear, what was the evolution about learning about commercial, right?
Or like the taxes, because you say it's a big tax deal and it's an education deal for your investors. For me, I'm like I know a little bit about taxes, but if I go talk to one of the investors about taxes, I just go tell them, talk to the CPA, because I don't know.
Yeah. And I was doing that, right?
Yeah.
And then I was getting pushback from these people's CPAs.
Really?
And what I realized was that unless they're a CPA that's well-versed in commercial real estate, they're doing it wrong.
Right.
I actually fired my accountant because he wasn't classifying me as a real estate professional, and that's what I do full-time, which comes with additional tax benefits.
Yeah.
So I read Tom Wheelwright's book, Tax-Free Wealth. And Tom Wheelwright is Robert Kiyosaki's CPA. He has a master's. I think he has a double master's in finance and in accounting from like the University of Utah. He's probably the foremost leading authority on this topic. So if you Google Tom Wheelwright, tax-free wealth, you'll see a lot of his conversations about the tax benefits of it. So
I've sent
his book to a lot of investors and to their CPAs, because education for them too. I mean, if they're just doing tax returns for W-2 employees, they don't understand the tax benefits that come along with the commercial real estate, right?
So
make it simple though. If you invest with us, we just send you a K-1 for your loss in year one. So it, you know, it's pretty easy to just give that to your CPA and say, hey, I made this investment, I lost 50 grand.
Yeah.
It shows that as a paper loss, you're actually still making your money, but that's how it works out. So it's really an education to the CPA. So we don't give people tax advice. We just send them the right people for tax advice.
And
oftentimes it's not their CPA because they're just not well-versed in it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I ended up doing with a couple of them was I gave them books like you. And then a couple of them was like, listen, I don't know the exact details. I know the roundabout. Like I've done a couple of deals and I know how to get her done. But it was like, here's my attorney's number. Give him a call. This is how he's going to structure the note. This is how he's going to structure the deed. And then here's my accountant. This is how he would do it if he was your accountant. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, that's been the best way for us to do it as well. And we want people to be fully educated, right? We don't want them going in with blinders on. We want full transparency as to what they're getting into.
Right.
The best people to lay out their risks is their attorneys. And I let both of our attorneys talk and try to figure out, you know, let's get to the bottom of all the questions that you have before you make this investment. Taking people's hard-earned money is a big responsibility. We want to make sure people are really well educated about what they're getting into.
Yeah, most definitely. So this year, the project that I'm seeing on Facebook is the big guy that now I've learned it's double than what I thought it was. So that's even more cool. But, going from single family to, are you hands on with the construction of that, or is that what you hired the right people for?
Or does so Sean lives down there.
Yeah.
Right, so we have three storage facilities that'll total almost 380,000 square feet of rentable square feet.
Jeez.
That are all being done right now. So the first and second ones are fully funded. The first one's getting a CO in like the next 30 days. So that's the one that you've been seeing a lot of because we're really close to the grand opening.
Yeah.
CubeSmart will manage all three of those for us, and they're just the third party manager. So they brand it, they market it, and they manage it. So pretty hands off. In terms of the day-to-day management. So Sean, who's our partner, he lives down there. He's managing the construction. And, you know, not to diminish what he's doing by any means, but it's not as hard as managing, let's say, a single family project. I mean, he's on top of those guys to make sure that they're hitting their numbers and hitting their timelines.
Yeah.
Like I said before, right, it's, you know, the guys who are building that, they built like the last firehouse in Orlando. They built the largest Porsche dealership in the country. They're not slouches, right? They don't need a ton of management. We need to be able to feed them money from the bank when they need it and not hold their timelines. So he's managing the construction management, right? He's the project manager for
purpose.
So those three projects are going on there. And then we have some student housing facilities in the Midwest. And they're managed again by third-party managers that we get, you know, weekly or monthly reports. We do weekly or monthly calls, depending on where we're at in like the turns. Are we doing new lighting? Are we doing new cabinets? Like, you know, depends on where we are in the stage of the project. It typically is more management intensive in the first 12 to 24 months.
Yeah.
After that, you go on autopilot, you know, more or less. But yeah, I mean, our job is now managing managers instead of managing projects.
Yeah, that's oftentimes view myself as an adult babysitter when it comes to, especially when you get multiple houses going.
It's you 100% are. And the people that we're babysitting have every excuse in the book.
Yeah. What tire blew out this time? What transmission's gone today? Like, how many transmissions can you go through in a month?
It's very difficult to find. Yeah. The right people that fit into your business. But in this, it's project by project. It's you get to call somebody, you get to get multiple bids, and you let them know, hey, you're bidding on a $14 million job, right?
Right.
Do you want the job or not? And these guys, they come in, they competitively bid. They don't call you when it rains too hard. They don't call. I mean, they're there. They have timelines, and they get back charged if they don't hit them.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I bought a foreclosed partial new build. So it was foundation, everything was roughed in and then dried in aside from windows. And it's still going smoothly. But in the beginning, I was like, this is just like a rehab. But then we had the city meeting, the recon meeting, and they're like, well, what are you going to do for irrigation? I'm like, I have to put in irrigation. What is this crap? And they're like, well, when do you plan on putting the sidewalk? I'm like, freaking sidewalk, and now I got to put in a sidewalk. So this is all things that you probably don't deal with when you've got the big GCs in place. But there's a lot of things that were different in the building world for sure.
Yeah, and I mean, once you get the full finals, right? Then it's like we knew all that going in.
Yeah.
So it was like you go through the city planning phase, you submit multiple things, and once the architectural engineering, everything is. You know, you get your finals, then just pull the trigger and turn and burn.
Yeah. Okay. In these ones, these bigger deals, there's a lot of due diligence, and a lot of market research. as most of the companies that I know that are doing, they're hiring out this type of due diligence and market research, you know, seeing if that specific area can support 130,000 square feet of market space. What's a research like that typically take, or how long does that typically take?
So, I mean, Orlando's the second fastest growing city in the country. So the metric wasn't difficult to see that population is booming there.
Yeah.
Florida has a very high water table, so there's no basements. And again, the HOAs don't allow for certain types of storage. So there's a need.
Yeah. Now,
you know, once you identify the land, then you have to identify whether or not you can put storage on there. The first big one that you're talking about that we did, Sean took that through the entire entitlement phase and rezoned it.
Right.
The third one that we're building that we already own the land that we're closing out the raise on pretty soon here is we bought that fully entitled.
Wow. Right?
I just got the appraisal back late last night. It was, congratulations on your baby. Here's our appraisal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, we're all in that project for about 10.2, and they expect 14.7 valuation when we're done building it, which is like 6 months out.
Yeah.
Right. So not bad. Awesome. We made $4.5 million and we didn't even occupy it yet. They expect that to be worth about $18 million once we get it stabilized. So great project.
Yeah.
And the feasibility report basically told us that, right? We spend money on feasibility reports. CubeSmart does a feasibility study. The bank does a feasibility study.
Yeah.
Everybody wants to know if this project's going to work, right? If you're buying in New Jersey and you say, oh, we're going to put 150,000 square feet, likely it's saturated already.
Yeah.
So you have to know that. But it's not rocket science. I think a lot of people get hung up on like, well, where am I going to invest and how do I know if it's going to be good? You pay for that. I mean, you build that into your underwriting and you say, you know, are people moving in or out of this area, right? I mean, you have my partner, Travis, and our chief operating officer, Sean, are currently walking our project that we have under contract in Columbus, Ohio. Mm-hmm. Columbus, Ohio has 2 million people in their MSA, and they expect it'll be at 3 million by 2025.
Jeez. Right?
That's a big population growth. So looking to buy there. It's a gentrifying area. Values are going up. So if we could buy some value add stuff with in-place cash flow, then it's not rocket science to figure out that the values are going to go up.
Right.
California, New York, and New Jersey are the top three exited states in the country. We don't invest there.
Right.
Yes, people move there, and yes, there's a lot of people there, so they'll continue to be born there.
Yeah.
But a mass exodus of people leaving the state is not a good sign.
Yeah.
So, you know, and people will invest in Manhattan forever, but I don't, you know, there's no cash flow there, right? You're banking on appreciation. So your grandkids will be rich. Congratulations. But we need cash flow now.
Right.
So we look in the Midwest and Southeast, which is where typically populations are going. So to answer your question, you know, it's just looking at economic drivers, right? Population growth, job diversity. Will the project get supported? I mean, it's much better to spend $10,000 on a feasibility study and say no than it is to spend $14 million and it not work. So,
exactly.
You know, it's pretty simple to do. You just need good consultants and a good team. That's what I love about this space even more so than residential is you get to rely on a lot of other people. You don't have to be the smartest guy in the room because the deal will absorb you hiring the smartest guy.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's awesome. That's one of those things as you learn when you get into it, you're like, you can't do it all. And that's what I mean, especially me in the beginning, I was like, I'm just going to remodel this whole house myself. I'm going to save some money. I'm going to do this. And so we ended up remodeling our first house and realized deal two is like, there's no way we're going to get as many deals as we want doing it all ourselves. So,
good. It took me 5 years to have that realization. So congratulations. On having it.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, mine was kind of just forced on me because as I'm remodeling the first one, I get another good deal under contract. So then I go to my buddy and lender and he's like, no, I'm not giving you money for this one because you've already got all your money. I know you got all your money tied up in this one, so I'm not going to give you more money. And then something goes wrong. So he's like, but I'll partner with you. And so we did a 50-50 buy-in and I saw he never went to the house. He viewed it to make sure I still, you know, could tell what a rehab cost. And from the day we closed to the day he brought it to the buyers, he was never there. And it was just, he had a, and still to this day has the same guy, but he had the superintendent running around checking on all his properties and making sure that the contractors are doing what they're supposed to do. And I was like, that's the way it's got to be done. So
that's it, man. I mean, even the Bible tells you that you should be the lender, not the borrower.
Right.
Why would the money makes the rules?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, cool, man. It's awesome. I could probably talk to you off for another couple of hours on commercial. It's super exciting.
Real quick, I know we're about to wrap up, right?
Yeah.
So barriers to entry, how do you overcome them?
Yeah.
Let me just give you our quick and dirty, like how we overcame it.
Yeah, yeah.
We were calling a lot of brokers. We weren't getting the time of day because nobody cares that you're going to flip a lot of houses.
Yeah.
Can you perform on this deal, right? They have relationships with their sellers. They don't want to look like an idiot after they get it under contract and you can't perform. So most of these deals that get sold, they get sold before they hit the open market, right? You're not seeing them on LoopNet.
Right.
So our mentor, Corey, who's in some of our other deals, said, hey, look, the money's not in the deal. The money's in the money. You guys have lenders that have given you money for your flips. Bring them over into the commercial space, help raise some money, manage the deal, learn from the inside, partner with a guy who's actually getting good deals.
Yeah.
Fun deals. And we did. That's how we cut the line. After 18 months of underwriting and putting LOIs out and getting our teeth kicked in, we finally just said, hey, I have money. And Sean took a flyer on us and said, hey, fund this deal for me and we'll be partners.
Yeah.
And we did. And the law of the first deal was real. And we started, you know, we did six deals right after that, like continually raising capital. And
right
now that's kind of our niche, is we're working with guys that have 10 plus years experience, $150 million or better under management. And we've grown our portfolio to $70 million in the last 12 months because of that. So don't reinvent the wheel. If you want to learn this business, don't listen to it. I mean, look, listen to your podcast, read your books. I mean, yeah, obviously educate yourself. You have to, but there has been no better education than getting into a deal and being on every phone call with the lender, with the property manager, with the project manager, with the general contractor, with our partners, asking the right questions. There's no better education than learning from within.
Yeah.
And instead of paying for that education, like we had to in the mastermind that we got into for the residential space, now we brought money into the space, got equity out of the deal because we're managing the deal, learning from the inside, flying down, walking the site, doing all of the things that the general partners are supposed to do.
Yeah.
Paid to learn. So find people out there that are doing it.
Yeah.
Find people that you gel with, that, you know, you can build a good relationship with. That's the other thing that I love about this business, is you don't have to work with people you don't like. I mean, there's a lot of guys doing this stuff.
Yeah.
So just find your people and say, hey, I want to help out. I want to join your team for this deal, right?
Correct.
You don't have to get married. You can just do a deal together.
Yeah, yeah.
If it works out, great. If it doesn't, that's okay. We'll move on to the next deal.
Yeah.
So find the people that are doing it and say, hey, you're doing big deals. I want to do big deals too. How can I add value to you? And man, this space is so different than the residential. It's not cutthroat. Everybody has a real big abundance mindset. Everybody's a giver. There's people that are just jumping on planes to fly out to do due diligence with us on a moment's notice because we don't know what we're doing. And they're like, we'll help. Don't worry.
Yeah.
It's been really cool. And it cut our barrier to entry significantly. And now, you know, now we're flying.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. I mean, you said it was 14 months later.
Yeah, man. 14 months later, $70 million of the deals.
Jeez. You said you're going to bring on a couple more, I know, 30, 35 million by first quarter next year. What do you envision growth into 2020, 2021?
So I can show you our whole accountability chart and our quarterly rocks and where we're going to go.
Yeah.
You know, we expect to do $100 million in 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most of our goals are tied to what we're able to give away. So our goals in, you know, by focusing on how much we have to give away, mm-hmm. it'll, you know, flow down to us. But in the next 3 years, by month 36, we expect to be able to give away seven figures into the different nonprofits that we partner with. And every deal that we do, we put a nonprofit into the deal as if they were an investor without having to put any capital in. We carve that out of our equity. Doesn't affect the returns for the investors. by investing with us, you kind of intrinsically partner with these nonprofits that are doing good stuff around the world.
Yeah.
And they're getting quarterly checks just like an investor would. And then when we exit, they get a big windfall as well. So we're able to give away a lot more by doing it that way than we would if we were just flipping.
Yeah.
And so by being able to give away seven figures in the next 36 months, you know, it relates to, I think, 2,500 doors under management or so.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. That's incredible, because we've in the past couple of years been really putting a big target on that goal as well. Is we just got to do our best to help. I mean, why else are we here? I mean, help the impoverished and the ones that need the hands up. But
yeah, I mean, and that's past our tithe, right? So I'm a Christian guy, so we tithe. So 10% of my income goes back to my home church. And then that additional is offerings. That's beyond what we're giving back just to our own home church. So that's, we actually have a call this week where we're going to let a new nonprofit know that they're going to get a stake in this new storage facility that we're closing. And it should make them somewhere in the vicinity of $500,000 over the next 3 years. And, you know, a ministry that's based in Kenya, that's big dollars going to them that can impact a lot of people. So we're really excited.
That's awesome. We just got back from Nigeria. It was an incredible experience. And I'm hoping off camera, I'll ask you how you structure that. Cause that'd be incredible. Cause me and my fiance were actually just talking about it, as we want to take each individual property, let's say a single family house. And if it's cash flowing $500 a month, we want to be able to set aside, okay, this bucket of properties goes to us living, while this bucket goes to this organization, this bucket goes to that organization. The cash flow goes to those. And ultimately, the appreciation will capitalize off that in the future. But setting aside certain properties
You can still capitalize on the depreciation, because as a 501c3, they're not allowed to take it. So you actually have to do a pass through. You can't actually put them in the operating agreement. So you have to pass through. So what we do is we just create a spreadsheet, and we know the equity percentage of that deal that goes to that nonprofit. And it comes into our company and then goes right back out the door as a pass through entity, because then they avoid UBIT, which is unintended business income tax.
Yeah.
Because it's outside of their scope of business. But yeah, I'm happy to talk to you about how to structure that. It's pretty simple. You know, you just have internal records, and then they'll give you kind of your giving, your end of year giving statement, and you hand that to your accountant. And then you can, on commercial deals, you capitalize on the depreciation. So the accelerated depreciation that we're taking, you know, our average investor is taking 37 to 45% of their initial contribution as a write-off in year one.
Wow.
So they can do that. So that'll pass through to the general partnership.
Yeah. That's awesome. Wow. Okay. Lots to learn.
Good stuff though.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate it. And I don't want to take up your whole morning. How's Noah doing anyways? Because he came in, saw before we jumped on here, 11 hours ago, as you put on Facebook. So he couldn't be but 15 hours old. How's he doing?
Yeah, he's doing great. He arrived about 3 weeks early, which was an answer to prayer for my wife, because she was done.
Yeah, right.
Pregnant anymore. So he's doing good. I'm going to head back up to the hospital and hang out with them for the day. And you know, again, that's just the virtue of this business, and the blessing that it gives us is we get to go and take the day off and just go spend it with the hospital and hang out with Noah. And baby and wife all doing well.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you taking your time out and jumping on the podcast here with me.
Yeah, brother.
I learned a lot, but now my mind's so clustered, I can't concentrate on on my day now. I totally forgot I had the closings today, and now I got to retrain that. And then I got to look for bigger deals. That's all I got to do now. Just bigger deals.
Well, you know where we are. So anything we can do to help, we're happy to.
Cool. I appreciate it. If anybody wants to reach out to you for any questions or potentially parting on the next deal or something, where can they find you?
Yep. So you can check us out at freefromwallstreet.com.
Mm-hmm.
And you can just fill out a form there and we'll get in contact with you. Or if you want to reach me directly, the name of the company is Integrity Holdings Group.
Mm-hmm.
And my email is steven@integrityhg.com.
Thank you for listening. Like what you hear? Be sure to subscribe and head over to freefromwallstreet.com and sign up for our free guides to help you and your family invest with purpose.